Don't be so quick to buy into what authority prescribes.
What I'm saying is, you might have taken care of your wolf problem, but everyone around town is going to think of you as the crazy son of a bitch who bought landmines to get rid of wolves.
At about 9 years old, I started developing a strange, uneasy feeling in my joints. It felt kind of like a little tiny person was inside them, tickling me. I wasn't in pain, but I was uncomfortable a lot of the time, and the sensation had an unfortunate side effect. It caused frequent muscle spasms. My mother encouraged me to see a doctor, but the physician I went to couldn't find anything wrong with me.
He's growing fast, and it's taking a toll. It's natural. It will pass.
My brother Dan offered a different diagnosis.
Maybe it's 'cause you're a gay,
he suggested one night, after I'd complained to my dad for the umpteenth time at dinner.
Quiet!
My dad barked at my brother.
Does it hurt?
He asked me. No, it's just, I don't know, weird.
Thank you for that detailed description, Ernest fucking Hemingway. If you're not feeling pain, then what's the problem?
I don't know. It makes me have to stretch and stuff, I responded.
He twitches all the time, Dad, my brother chirped.
Your mouth twitches all the time,
my dad snapped at him. Then he turned to me.
Okay, well, if it starts hurting, let me know.
From that point forward, everyone in my family referred to the uneasiness in my joints as the twitches, which sounds like some kind of 18th century sexually transmitted disease British aristocrats got from prostitutes. But it was a catchy name, and it ended up sticking. When I was growing up, my dad personally selected my primary care doctor. For the most part, he picked doctors he had professional relationships with. The one time I expressed annoyance at having zero say in choosing my doctor, he snapped.
I'm sorry, did you go to medical school? Did you spend the last 25 fucking years of your life in medicine? No, you did jack shit. Let me handle picking your doc, and do me a favor and put a thumb in your ass and be quiet.
But when I was 21 years old, my physician moved away, and when my insurance company gave my dad a list of doctors to choose from, it turned out that he was unfamiliar with all of them, so he let me review the list and pick out a doctor myself.
Okay, listen, this is going to sound biased, but pick someone with a Jewish last name,
he instructed me. That's racist, Dad.
Racist? Oh, give me a fucking break. It's not racist. I just know a lot of Jewish doctors and they're good. And let me remind you that I'm a Jewish doctor and, you know what? Fuck you! Pick whoever you want!
He said as he stormed out of the living room. So I picked a doctor at my dad's hospital, and a few months later I went in for a routine checkup. The doctor was a young guy, short, with dark hair. He was like a Jewish Tom Cruise, with a lisp. We went through all the normal checkup routines. Breathe in and out, turn your head and cough, slam the mini hammer on my knees, etc. Okay, you're healthy, he said as we were wrapping up. Is there anything else? I thought about it and was about to say no, but then remembered the twitches and I figured I might as well speak up. I described my symptoms, and he spent a few minutes asking questions and doing a few more physical tests, moving my legs back and forth, pressing on my joints. He asked me to wait in his office and left the room for a couple minutes. Listen, there's a drug called Zoloft, he said as he entered his office with a prescription pad in hand. He launched into a description of Zoloft and its history and told me that he thought it might help me. I don't know that it will, but it might. You might be able to get rid of your joint problems entirely. I think we should take a shot, he said. I told him I'd love to, and he wrote me a prescription, which I took straight to the pharmacy and got filled. That night, my dad and I sat down to dinner, just the two of us, since my mom was working late. When he asked me how my doctor's appointment went, I told him that I was given a clean bill of health. Oh, also he prescribed some stuff for the twitches, I added.
What kind of stuff?
He asked, his eyebrows furrowing into a steep mountain of hair. Well, you know, the doctor was talking about how he wasn't sure what was causing my twitches, so, you know.
No, I do not know. Enlighten me,
he said between clenched teeth. I told him I'd filled a prescription for a drug called Zoloft.
Bring me those fucking pills right now,
he shouted, holding out his hand as if I were going to make them magically appear.
What? Why? What is your problem? You have no idea what that shit is for. It's an antidepressant. It's for depressed people. Are you depressed?
I told him that I didn't think I was, but that I was tired of having the twitches. They kept me up at night, and I always sounded ridiculous when I tried to explain to people why parts of my body would suddenly jerk. My dad took a deep breath.
You're making that face like you got a shit. Calm down for a moment, he said.
Then he sat back in his chair.
Listen, imagine you own a farm. On that farm, you got a bunch of sheep. And every night, wolves come and kill your sheep. It's a problem. You want to fix it. Now, you could go and put a bunch of landmines around your farm, and every time one of the wolves comes near your farm, it steps on one of them landmines and blows it to fucking pieces. You think, problem solved, right?
He stared at me for a few moments until I realized he wanted me to answer that question. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about right now, I said.
Jesus Christ, you're fucking obtuse. What I'm saying is, you might have taken care of your wolf problem, but everyone around town is going to think of you as the crazy son of a bitch who bought landmines to get rid of wolves. That's how they'll treat you. In fact, that will be the first thing they associate with you. And not only that, now the only way you know how to get rid of wolves is blowing them the fuck up. You get what I'm saying now?
He sat back in his chair, and a few moments of silence passed as the two of us stared at each other. Dad, I'm taking the pills.
God damn it, the hell you are!
He shot up out of his chair and stormed into my room. I heard him rooting around furiously, opening and closing drawers, unzipping and rummaging through my backpack. When he returned to the dining room, he was holding my bottle of Zoloft. He marched over to the sink, poured the $20 worth of pills down the drain, and turned on the garbage disposal for good measure.
You'll thank me later,
he said as he returned to the table and resumed eating. What in the hell do I tell the doctor? I asked.
I don't give a shit. Go back to your doctor and tell him to kiss my ass.
A few weeks later, my dad came home early from work and popped his head into my bedroom where I was doing homework.
Grab a snack to take with you. We're gonna go down to the hospital, he said.
Why? Please don't harass my doctor.
Give me a fucking break. I'm not a maniac.
I got in his car and we drove to UCSD Medical Center. We walked into the waiting area, where my dad approached the reception desk and checked us in. 2 minutes later, the nurse called my name and led my dad and me back to a room where an older, gray-haired doctor was waiting.
Sam, good to see you,
the older doc said, extending his hand to shake my dad's. They chatted for a couple minutes, making incomprehensible doctor jokes that ended with punchlines like,
And then it turned out it wasn't even a goddamn myocardial infarction!
Followed by hysterical laughter. I sat atop the doctor's table, stone-faced and trying to minimize the rustling noises emanating from the thin white paper that coated it, while I waited to be acknowledged.
So, what can I do for you, Sam?
The doctor said.
The kid's got some uneasiness in his joints. I was hoping you could help him, because it's really a pain in his ass. Tell him, son.
Well, it sort of feels like I'm being tickled from the inside of me.
God damn it, use medical terms, he's a doctor!
My dad barked. The old doctor performed the same tests my other doctor had and then turned to my dad as if I wasn't in the room.
I think the culprit here is your boy has had quite a growth spurt and it put a lot of strain on his joints. Now he's feeling the effects of it.
So you're saying he grew funny, huh?
My dad replied.
Well, more or less, yes.
At last I had an answer. We left the doctor's office and, as we were walking down the hospital hallway, my dad turned to me and whispered,
Shit. I could have told you that. Fucking doctors, huh?
On the proper technique for growing a garden.
It's just watering plants, Justin. You just take a goddamn hose and you put it over the plant. You don't even pay rent. Just do it. Shit.
On moving out of my parents' house for the first time.
I'd say I was gonna miss you, but you're moving 10 minutes away. So instead I'll just say don't come over and do your fucking laundry here.
On furnishing one's home.
Pick your furniture like you pick a wife. It should make you feel comfortable and look nice, but not so nice that if someone walks past it, they want to steal it.
On coming over to my new apartment unannounced and seeing my room for the first time.
Why is there a mural of two people fucking on your wall? Son, let me be the first to tell you that you're not Andy fucking Kaufman. When you get famous, maybe shit like this will be funny, but right now all it says to me is this kid never gets laid. Ever.
On my response to having my tire slashed.
Oh, don't go to the goddamn cops. They're busy with real shit. I don't want my tax dollars going to figuring out who thinks you're an asshole.
On living on a budget.
Why are you going over your monthly expenses? No, let me shorten this process for you. You make dog shit, so don't spend any money.
On my friend's response to getting a minor in possession ticket.
He cried? Jesus, don't ever have that happen to you. Well, no, try not to get a ticket, sure, but if you do, don't cry like a fucking baby.
On getting an internship at Quentin Tarantino's production
company. That is one ugly son of a bitch. Oh, yeah, no, congratulations. If you see him, try not to stare at his face if you've eaten anything.
On my interest in going skydiving.
You won't go do that, I know it. Son, I used to wipe your ass. I know you better than you know you. Fine, Mom used to wipe it, but I was usually nearby.
On the arm injury that ended my baseball career.
I'm really sorry, son. If you're pissed off and you need to blow off some steam, let me know. We'll go smash some golf balls or something. Oh, right, the arm. Well, there's other non-physical ways to blow off steam.
On Pringles flavors.
I'm not eating something called pizza-licious. That's not even a fucking adjective. You can't just add licious to nouns. That's bullshit.
You never stop worrying about your children.
They'll gut you like a pig, piss on your corpse, and then say, "Welcome to Mexico!"
By my junior year of college, I had moved out of my parents' house and into a three-bedroom house in Pacific Beach, San Diego, which I shared with my best friend Dan and a girl we were friends with. Even though my new place was only 10 minutes away from my parents, it might as well have been in Sweden for all my dad cared. There was no way he was going to visit.
I don't want to know what goes on in that house,
he said when I finally asked him if he wanted to come check it out. Dad, there's nothing bad going on in the house.
No, you're not understanding me. I don't care what goes on in that house. It's called apathy. Look it up.
I was living on my own, but I still headed home once a week to do my laundry, raid the fridge, and take advantage of anything else I possibly could while I was there.
You just barge in and take whatever you want, whenever you want it. It's like you're the goddamned SS and I'm living in fucking Nazi Germany.
My dad said after coming in from the backyard, where he was watering the roses one afternoon, to find me in the kitchen eating the bagel with cream cheese he had prepared for himself just moments earlier. Even though he wouldn't admit it, I always knew my dad was happy to see me when I came home. I'd usually head over at night, when he was home from work, and we'd have a nice chat about things that were going on in each other's lives. It was the first time I had ever felt like I had an adult relationship with my dad. We were growing closer and becoming friends. I realized that we'd really broken down some barriers one evening in late June when he asked me to help him with a project in his garden that Friday.
Friday, come over at 4. Don't be late. I don't want to be fucking with this after dark. I'll buy you dinner afterwards, he offered.
Since he'd purchased the house in 1972, my dad's garden had taken over almost every spare inch of our yards, front and back, and he'd planted not only flowers, but tomatoes, lettuce, even corn. He loved his garden and spent most of his free time taking meticulous care of it. He was also very particular about who touched it. That Friday, he was going to put up some fencing to grow tomatoes, a difficult job for one guy. He normally did the tough jobs on his own anyway. One time, many years earlier, I had tried to help him on a similar project, and while bending the wire fence to wrap it into a cylinder, my hand had slipped and accidentally released the metal, which whipped around and stabbed my dad in the leg.
God damn it, fuck!
He screamed in pain, before turning to me and adding,
Go away!
So when my dad asked me to help out on his garden that coming Friday, the request meant a lot to me. He didn't need my help. He wanted it. On Thursday, the night before I was supposed to help him out, I was studying with a girl named Stacy from my communications class. We were taking a summer school course because each of us had dropped a class during the school year. I had been in a few classes with Stacy before and developed a major crush on her. I had never asked her out or even hinted at my feelings, mostly because she had a boyfriend, but even if she hadn't, I doubt I wouldn't have gotten up the courage to make a move. She was blonde, with large breasts, which I had pictured in my head numerous times during a variety of different fantasies I played out while masturbating. As we sat studying on a futon in her bedroom, she turned to me and said,
"I've got to tell you something. Peter and I broke up."
This was exactly how 96% of all my masturbatory fantasies of her started.
"I can't study right now. I can't concentrate. I want to do something fun. You want to do something fun?"
she asked. "Yes," I said, trying to act cool.
"Some of my friends and I are going down to Rosarita tonight for the 4th. We rented a hotel room. You should come."
She could have said,
"Some of my friends are going to shove bottle rockets in her asses and then light them and shoot them at a police station. You should come."
And I would have said yes. I told her I needed 15 minutes to pack my stuff and strutted as calmly as I could out of her house. Then I dashed through the dark to my car where, with beads of sweat forming at my temples, I pressed my foot all the way down on the accelerator. Unfortunately, the top speed of my 1986 Oldsmobile Brougham was about 57 miles an hour, so it took me longer than I hoped to get home. I nervously tossed a few shirts, a pair of swim trunks, and every single condom I could find, which was about 30, in my backpack. I drove back to Stacy's house, and she, her three best girlfriends, who had arrived in my absence, and I hopped in her friend's Chevy Blazer and took off for Mexico. A small Mexican beach town right next to Tijuana, Rosarito, is a lot like the bleachers in Fenway Park during a Yankees-Red Sox game, crowded, dirty, and filled with thousands of loud, drunk Americans who haphazardly throw their garbage on the ground. Yet somehow it's still kind of charming. Rosarito's biggest draws are that the drinking age is 18 and everything is dirt cheap. The five of us spent the ride down the Pacific Coast Highway drinking tecates and talking excitedly about how drunk we were going to get as soon as we arrived in Mexico.
"I'm going to get so fucking wasted,"
Stacy's friend in the passenger seat said.
"Justin, are you going to get fucking wasted or are you going to be a fag?"
she asked, turning to me. I wasn't sure how she decided those were the only two paths to go down this weekend, but I clearly saw the direction she was hoping I would lean toward.
"I'm getting fucking wasted!"
I screamed, trying to match her intensity. Apparently I did, because everyone cheered, and then Stacy grabbed my crotch. It was a pretty unsexy move, and sort of hurt, but any interaction my crotch had with Stacy's hand was welcome. A couple hours later, we pulled up to our hotel in Rosarito and checked into our dingy room, which contained only one bed, a bathroom, and three different paintings of a large-breasted Mexican woman being carried off by a Spanish conquistador. We immediately started taking shots of tequila from the bottle we had purchased at the hotel's gift shop. I went into the bathroom and put one condom in my sock and one in my baseball hat, just in case Stacy and I didn't make it back to the hotel room. I threw some water on my face, patted my hair into place, and brushed my teeth. When I came out of the bathroom, all three of Stacy's friends were crowded around her, and she was curled up in a ball on the floor, crying hysterically.
"I miss Peter! I can't believe we're fucking broken up!"
Stacy sobbed as her friends tried to calm her down. Then Stacy got up, ran past me to the bathroom, and vomited in the toilet. For the next day and a half, Stacy sat in the hotel room with her friends, bawling and rehashing every detail of the breakup. A couple of times I went to a bar by myself, stood around for an hour, talked to no one, then went back to our room, which still reeked of vomit. On Saturday afternoon, we piled into the Blazer and drove silently back up the coast to the U.S.-Mexico border. Stacy sat next to me the entire time, sleeping. As we crossed the border, I turned my cell phone back on, since I hadn't had reception in Mexico. It began buzzing to indicate that I had new messages. As I punched in my voicemail access code, it dawned on me that I had forgotten to help my dad with the garden.
"You have 4 new messages,"
the robotic voice declared. I was half expecting it to add,
"You are so fucked."
The first message played.
"Son, it's Dad. I need you to pick up something from the Home Depot before you come over. Call me back."
"Next message,"
the robotic voicemail alerted me as I began to feel nauseous.
"Son, where the fuck are you? I said to be over at 4, right? It's 4:10. Call me."
The next message contained just a few moments of silence and then the sound of hanging up. I felt a little relieved. Maybe he was over it by now.
"Next message received today at 3:30 p.m.
said the robot.
"What in the fuck is going on? I stopped by your place, and your roommate said you're in Mexico! Are you in fucking Mexico? Call me!
I started sweating and couldn't keep my legs still, which was unfortunate, seeing as we were just about to drive through the Border Patrol inspection. The officer waved us through, even though I'm pretty sure I looked like I was sitting on about 2,000 pounds of cocaine and hiding a half dozen illegal aliens in our trunk. Once we were across the border, Stacy's friend pulled over at the first exit.
I am totally fiending for some Jack in the Box, she said.
No, I need to go home right now, I snapped, my voice ascending to a note I hope no woman ever hears out of my mouth again.
Whoa, chill out. We're just gonna grab some Jumbo Jacks. God.
In my head, I was fantasizing about jumping into the front seat, kicking her out of the car, slamming the door, and stepping on the gas. Instead, I just sat in the dining area of the Jack in the Box while four girls leisurely enjoyed their hamburgers. I called Dan to see how much damage was done.
Your dad looked all pissed off. I told him you were in Mexico, Dan said.
You told him I was in Mexico? Why did you tell him I was in Mexico? I screamed.
Because you were in Mexico?
I hung up the phone. Shortly after, Stacy and her friends moseyed back to the car. We continued our drive up the coast and, upon reaching San Diego, headed to Stacy's apartment, where my car was parked. I grabbed my travel bag out of the blazer and briskly walked toward my car.
Okay, bye,
Stacy said snidely. Yeah, bye, sorry, I replied, jumping into my car and slamming the door. I began the drive over to my parents' house, trying to figure out what lie I could tell to defuse the situation. I came to the conclusion that there was really no defusing this because it had too many volatile elements. I blew off my dad, I disappeared and was unreachable, and, the final straw, I had gone to Mexico. My parents had irrational fears of Mexico and assumed that once you crossed the border, drug runners made you swallow a heroin balloon, and then within the hour, you were in a bathtub full of ice, and they were harvesting your kidneys. As I pulled up to the house, I spotted my dad's car in the driveway. I walked up to the front door and opened it. I saw my dad sitting in the living room, staring right at me as if he had been in that position for the last 2 days.
Where in the fuck have you been?
He screamed, getting up from his chair and quickly moving toward me like an overweight panther.
Listen, hold on, I said.
And then I launched into an elaborate lie about a school project and a birthday that made no sense before he cut me off.
Mexico? You went to fucking Mexico? They'll gut you like a pig, piss on your corpse, and then say, "Welcome to Mexico," he screamed. You say you're going to fucking be somewhere, you'll fucking be there,
he added.
I know,
I hollered back in defense.
No, you don't know! You don't know shit! Everyone is worried sick about you! I got your mother freaking out, then everybody else! I called the cops to look for you!
You called the cops? I said.
Yeah, I called the cops!
Well, shouldn't you call them and tell them you found me?
My dad paused for a split second.
They'll figure it out,
he said, the tone in his voice changing. I looked at him. He very rarely lied to me, and when he did, it was obvious.
You didn't call the cops, did you?
I asked suspiciously.
I called somebody, he replied.
Was that somebody the cops? Silence fell over the room.
No,
he said, a little embarrassed.
But fuck you! I could have called the cops! I should have called them! But I figured you were just being dopey, and I'd have wasted their time!
I realized I had somewhat disarmed him and should just cut my losses now and try to make things right. So I apologized profusely, explained that I had gotten caught up and completely forgotten about our date, and reaffirmed all the reasons why I was an idiot.
Okay, I get it. You don't have to keep listing reasons why you're a dumb shit,
he said, interrupting my laundry list of self-insults. He motioned me over to him. I cautiously approached. Then he grabbed me and gave me a big hug.
You little shit, he said. I can't wait till you have some kid, and you got to worry about what happens to him. You never stop worrying about your children. It sucks. You watch what you stick your dick into, because this is your life, this bullshit right here.
He released me from the hug and grabbed a plastic grocery bag filled with chips.
Grab that bottle of ketchup. We're late for the barbecue your uncle's throwing.
I was going to meet Dan at the beach, actually, I said tentatively, hoping he would respect my 4th of July plans.
Shut the fuck up and grab the bag. You got some balls.
On finding the best deal.
Man, you should have seen your mom tear that Radio Shack manager a new asshole. I would venture to say she made a home inside his asshole. That'll be the last time Radio Shack tries to fuck with your mother.
On non-traditional entertainment.
There's something to be said for sitting around and drinking a beer while you watch a dog try to fuck a punching bag.
On the baseball steroid scandal.
People are surprised Mark McGwire did steroids? Look at him. He looks like they should have him in a stall on display at the fair with some poor son of a bitch cleaning up his shit.
On my decision to try to make it as a Hollywood screenwriter.
It's like being on a merry-go-round, except the horse you're riding fucks you.
On driving through West Hollywood, where I lived my first year in L.A.
There seemed to be a lot of gay people there. Oh, please, as if that's what I meant by that. Trust me, none of them would ever want to fuck you anyway. They're gay, not blind.
On being lonely and having trouble making friends.
Have you tried going out to places, talking to people, making an effort? Bullshit! Talking to someone in a Jiffy Lube waiting room is not making an effort.
On internet service.
I don't want it. I understand what it does. Yes, I do. And I don't give a shit if all your friends have it. All your friends have dopey fucking haircuts too, but you don't see me running to my barber.
On bragging.
I would simmer down a bit if I were you. Well, for one, the only one who was impressed was the little girl sitting behind you. And for two, they don't exactly hand out medals of fucking honor for eating two Denny's breakfast plates in one sitting.
On dealing with loud neighbors.
Have you told them it bothers you? Are they bigger than you? Are you afraid of getting your ass kicked? Ah, okay. I probably should have asked that question first. Would have saved time. Yeah, you're just gonna have to deal with the noise, son.
At the end of the day, at least you have family.
So there you go. Your mother thinks you're handsome. This should be an exciting day for you.
A couple of months after I graduated from college, I finally left my hometown of San Diego and moved to Los Angeles. I had studied film and television in college, specifically focusing on writing, and decided that I wanted to try my hand at becoming a screenwriter.
Listen, it's gonna be tough, and you're gonna eat a lot of shit at first, but you get past that, and you will succeed,
was the advice my dad gave my brother Evan at the September dinner when we both announced our new professional goals. Evan had decided to embark on a career in scuba diving.
Get ready for a fucking of biblical proportions,
was the advice he gave me about 20 seconds later, after I shared my plan. My dad believed in me, though, and supported my decision completely. In fact, he supported me so much that, unprompted, he offered to pay my first 3 months of rent in L.A. to help me get on my feet.
I figure, what's the point in dying and leaving you money when you probably won't need it? Might as well give it to you now when you need the help. Plus, I plan on blowing most of it on stupid shit when I get senile, he explained.
I found a two-bedroom apartment in a small, 10-unit white stucco building in West Hollywood. I shared it with a friend from college who was also trying to make it in the entertainment industry. The paint on our walls was peeling, and the carpet was covered in stains that would have made for a great CSI episode. Even though I grew up 2 hours south, I had rarely ventured to Los Angeles. I soon learned that my dad wasn't totally off base when he said,
Los Angeles is like San Diego's older, ugliest sister that has herpes.
Because I had barely any concept of what Los Angeles was like, I was met with a few surprises when I arrived. The first, during my first night in the apartment. I learned that I shared a bedroom wall with our neighbors when I got into my old queen-size bed and heard the sounds of loud, passionate lovemaking coming through the thin stucco wall. I had never seen my neighbors before, but I had watched my fair share of porn, so immediately I envisioned a blonde bombshell with huge breasts getting it on with a faceless man. My visual, paired with the live soundtrack, got me so excited that after listening for a few minutes, I popped into my desktop computer, the only porn DVD I owned, and rubbed one out before dozing off. The next day, I walked out of my apartment just as my sexually active neighbors were strolling out of theirs.
Hi, I'm Steven. This is my partner, Lucas,
my neighbor said to me, introducing his larger male companion.
Hey, I'm Justin. I just jerked off last night to you and your boyfriend having sex thinking you were a woman, and now I'm feeling fairly insecure about my sexuality, I thought.
I told them it was nice to meet them. My roommate was an impressive person and a hard worker, and within 2 weeks of moving to LA, she got an internship at a production company, as well as a full-time job to pay the bills. Before I had fully unpacked my bags, she was working 90 to 100 hours a week, and I hardly ever saw her. I spent my day sending query letters to production companies, trying to get internships, while also looking for work pretty much every place I could think of. The only job I could find was delivering apartment guides to 7-Elevens in the greater Los Angeles area. I'd show up in the morning at a warehouse, load up the back of my truck with the thin realty booklets, and then struggle with the directions for the next 8 hours, trying to find out where exactly I was supposed to drop them off. It was like taking the worst tour of Los Angeles imaginable, and the job was only freelance, so it didn't even offer the opportunity to make much money. I had only one real friend in LA, my writing partner Patrick, with whom I had directed my student film and written a screenplay for a feature film in college. Both were fairly poor attempts, but we had fun. We were learning, and most important, worked well together and had similar senses of humor. Patrick had lived in LA just a little longer than I and was showing me the ropes as best he could. Except for him, the only people I saw on a regular basis were the transvestite prostitutes who hung out in front of my apartment complex. One of them approached me a few weeks into my stay, and part of me was actually excited by the prospect of having a conversation with someone new.
"Is this your car?"
she asked, pointing to my white Ford Ranger.
"Yeah," I said. "My girlfriend accidentally threw up on it last night, but I washed it off. Just wanted to say sorry,"
she said before walking away. For the first time in my life, I was homesick.
"How's it going up there?"
my dad asked me over the phone when I called home after about a month to say hello.
"Oh, you know, pretty good," I said, not wanting him to see what a sad sack I felt like.
"Bullshit! You're lying! I can tell by your voice."
"It's not going so great, Dad." I told him everything that had been going on, just poured out all of the emotions that had been building up.
"From now on, when I ask how you're doing, I appreciate you being open, but don't tell me stories about you jerking off to your gay neighbors," he said, laughing. "Listen, you've only been up there a month. This shit takes time. Steven Spielberg didn't become Steven Spielberg in a month. He was probably just some asshole who's a lot fucking uglier than you, I might add."
He talked to me for a few more minutes about the Padres and the Chargers, how my brothers and my mom were doing, and afterward I felt a lot better. So I plugged away, and a couple of months later I got a job waiting tables at a place called Crocodile Cafe in Old Town Pasadena. It was basically a lower-key TGI Fridays. Landing the job was a minor victory, but my dad thought otherwise.
"Bullshit, you done good. It's hard to get a waiter job in L.A. All these fucking actors, they got all the jobs. Your mom and I are proud of you. We're gonna come up and take you out to celebrate," he said.
"That's not really necessary, Dad."
"Bullshit!"
My dad loves the word bullshit and delivers it with many different inflections. This particular time, his delivery said to me, "This is not something you can argue against." My parents wanted me to feel good about myself, and they knew I wasn't going to have a shot at being successful unless I did. I wasn't Charles Bukowski. My misery was not going to translate to literary genius and royalty checks. My dad ended the phone call with one emphatic sentence.
"I'm taking you to Lowry's Prime Beef."
Lowry's is mostly known for its seasoned salt, which you can purchase in almost any large grocery store. But they also have a famous steakhouse, Lowry's The Prime Rib Restaurant in Los Angeles, which my dad loves. Shortly after our phone call, he had my mom, who had broken him down and gotten internet on her computer in the house, create an email address for him just so he could send me an email with a link to the Lowry's website. The subject heading was Lowry's, and the body simply said,
"This is fucking prime beef,"
with the link to their menu. The next Friday, my parents picked me up in my brother's Chevy Blazer, which he had left with them since venturing to Hawaii to start his scuba diving career.
"Who's ready for some fucking prime beef?"
Dad said as I stepped into the car. Then he proceeded to ask me questions about my writing, life in Los Angeles, and pretty much anything else he could think of on the 20-minute drive to the intersection of La Cienega and Wilshire Boulevards where the restaurant sat. I had invited Patrick, who met us in the restaurant's lobby.
The four of us sat down at a table, and as soon as we had our drinks, my dad called for a toast to me and Patrick.
To you guys, for sticking your asses out on the line and going after it, and to Justin for getting a new job.
I never thought a person could so energetically toast a job that paid minimum wage, but my dad's pride was completely genuine. The waitress who was covering our table was blonde with big blue eyes. Even in the unflattering Lowry's waitress uniform, she looked very attractive. As usual, my dad went into full flirting mode. He started asking her every conceivable question about Lowry's history, the prime beef, the seasoned salts, and then moved on to questions about her personal life, where she lived, Hollywood, what she did, actress, and so on. When my mother made the mistake of trying to order the only seafood dish on the menu, my dad used the opportunity to crack a joke.
Ah, Joni, you're killing me! Killing me! This is Lowry's! This is prime beef! You can't come here and order seafood, he said, a little too enthusiastically to my mom. Am I right, or am I right? He added, gazing up at our waitress.
Though my dad likes to say he's not a flirt, his way with women is a big family joke. Whenever we call him on it, he replies with,
Oh, please, I'm a married man. I'd never cheat on your mother. And she'd cut off my nuts anyway if I did, so there'd be no point in cheating. She's Italian. She'd do it.
In addition to loving women, my dad has always had a great affection for waiters and waitresses. He thinks they're hard workers who often get treated poorly by customers, so any time he eats out, he tips 30 to 40%, no matter what. I glanced at the bill and noticed it was around $220, which was definitely the most expensive dinner he had ever taken me to. We almost never went out to fancy meals, so I could tell this meant a lot to him. As I stared at the bill, I saw him jot down $80 for the tip. Now, having worked in the restaurant industry for 8 years, as a waiter for 5 of them, I can tell you that we operate the same way a stripper does. Give us money and we'll pretend we like you. After our waitress saw the tip, she sashayed back to the table and began chatting us up even more. When my dad found out she was single, he pointed at me and said,
That one is single too. He lives up here now. You two should get together.
Because if there's any indication that two people should begin having sexual intercourse, it's that they live in the same city. 10 minutes later, we finally got up from the table. My dad thanked each and every employee he saw on the way out as if he were walking off stage after winning an Oscar. Then he grabbed a toothpick from the dispenser at the hostess desk, popped it in his mouth, and strolled out the door. My parents and I bid farewell to Patrick, and when the valet brought our car around, my dad jumped in the driver's seat, my mom in the passenger's, and me in the back. After a few moments of silence, he looked at me in the rearview mirror and said,
That waitress, she was sweet on you. She was chatting you up for 10 minutes.
No, you gave her a huge tip, so she was being nice. You asked her to describe in depth the beef preparation, and that took 8 of those 10 minutes, I replied.
You don't know shit. I know when a woman is sweet on someone, and that girl was sweet on you.
Our argument escalated, with him insisting she liked me, and me refusing to believe that, until finally it ended with my dad yelling,
Fine! She thought you were a jackass! You're right, I'm wrong!
Silence filled the car for about 15 seconds until my mom turned around, looked me in the eye, smiled, and said,
I think you're handsome.
So there you go. Your mother thinks you're handsome. This should be an exciting day for you, my dad barked.
We rode the rest of the way home mostly in silence. A few times, my dad pointed out landmarks he recognized from when he had lived in Los Angeles in the late 60s. We arrived at my apartment, and he parked the car on the street in front. You can just drop me off. You don't have to park, I said.
Bullshit,
he replied, jerking the emergency brake into place. Both my parents got out of the car, and my mom gave me a big hug and told me how much she loved me and how proud of me she was. Then my dad grabbed me and enveloped me in his standard bear hug, which consisted of squeezing the life out of me while simultaneously patting my back with his right hand.
Don't think you can't call unless something big happens. Don't be one of those guys, because those calls, they take a little while to happen, he said.
I know.
You're trying. You're giving it a go. That's a big deal to me. You may not think things you do mean shit, but remember, they mean shit to me, okay?
I know.
Yeah, you know everything. That's why you jerked off to your gay neighbors.
Dad, we're right in front of their apartment. He laughed, then gave me another hug.
You always got us. We're family. We ain't going anywhere. Unless you go on a fucking killing spree or something.
I would still love you, Justy. I would just want to know why you did it, my mom said earnestly, having gotten back into the car and rolled down her window.
My dad got back into the driver's seat and leaned over my mom to see out the passenger window.
Remember, family, he said. Also, how do I get back to I-5? I hate this fucking city.
On airlines alcohol selection.
They serve Jim Beam on airplanes. Tastes like piss. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference because you drink shit. I don't.
On managing one's bank account.
Don't get mad at the overdraft charge. No, no. See, there's your problem. You think of it as a penalty for taking out money you don't have, but instead, it might help you to think of it as a reminder that you're a dumb shit.
On corporate mascots.
Love this Mrs. Dash. The bitch can make spices. Jesus, Joni, it's a joke. I was making a joke. Mrs. Dash isn't even real, damn it.
On understanding one's place in the food chain.
Your mother made a batch of meatballs last night. Some are for you, some are for me, but more are for me. Remember that. More me.
On birthdays.
Listen, I don't give a fuck if you forget my birthday. I don't need people reminding me I'm closer to death. But your mom, she still enjoys counting them down. So cancel your fucking plans and drive down here for her birthday party. Fine, I'll let you know if she changes her mind and ceases to care about meaningless milestones.
On how to tell when a workout is complete.
I just did an hour on the gym machine. I'm sweaty and I have to shit. Where's my fanny pack? This workout is over.
On aging.
Mom and I saw a great movie last night. No, I don't remember the name. It was about a guy or... No, wait, fuck. Getting old sucks.
On the proper amount of enthusiasm.
You hear that? Your brother's engaged! Yeah? Did you just say yeah? What the fuck is that? No, that's not gonna fucking cut it unless you say it while you're doing a somersault or something.
Sometimes it's nice when people you love need you.
Listen, the dog likes garlic salt, so I give him fucking garlic salt.
After having lived in Los Angeles for about a year, I decided that it would be cool to get a dog. Notice that I said cool, not a good idea or cool to think about. I wanted a dog and wasn't considering non-dog options. When I was a kid, my family had a dog named Brownie, who I enjoyed playing with, particularly when my older brothers were no longer living at home. I loved that dogs just seemed to do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. It was a quality I admired. One time during a family dinner when I was around 13, I looked outside and Brownie was in the backyard, licking himself vigorously until he ejaculated on his own face. Then he lay down and went to sleep as if nothing happened. Self-administering oral sex is not my cup of tea, but you have to hand it to him for his ruthless determination to enjoy himself. A year out of college, I had a decent job waiting tables at an upscale Italian restaurant where I only needed to work about 3 days a week to make ends meet. I spent most of the rest of my time writing in my bedroom. I thought getting a dog might spice up my life a little bit.
You can barely take care of yourself. Where are you going to keep him?
My friend Dan asked. My apartment, I said.
You don't have a yard. Where's he going to go to the bathroom or run around? Dogs need to run around. They can't just sit around an apartment.
I'll get a small dog. If I was tiny, my apartment would seem huge, right? I knew my dad would probably have a similar response, so I didn't tell him, or any of our family members who might leak the news to him. My roommate had grown up with dogs in her house and did not object. So I made a trip up to the pound in Lancaster, California, which is about 50 miles northeast of L.A., and scoured the narrow, cage-lined halls, passing dozens of sad and snarling faces in search of the perfect puppy. I want something that's gonna stay small, I said to the pound employee who was guiding me. The worker assured me she'd help me find a small dog and led me to a cage filled with 6 tiny brown puppies. I couldn't tell what kind of dogs they were. They just looked like mutts. I pointed out the smallest one, and a week later, after he had gotten his shots, I returned to the pound to pick him up. I named him Angus, after Angus Young, the lead guitarist of AC/DC. Very early on, I realized I might have made a huge mistake.
Angus was a fun, loving dog, but he had an unbelievable amount of energy and suffered from serious abandonment issues. Every time I left him alone in the apartment, I'd return to find my living room carpet covered in dog crap. Evidently, he'd take a rebellious or emotional dump, then step in it and walk around the house like he was recreating a Jackson Pollock painting. At first, I thought he did this because he had to empty his bowels, so I started taking him out to do his business right before I left. He'd go right away, but still, when I came back home after leaving him alone, his feces would be everywhere. I'd have to get out my cleaning supplies and go to town for an hour on the mess just to make the apartment bearable. My roommate was a good sport, but she was quickly tiring of the situation. About 2 months after I got Angus, I returned home to find that he had gotten into the cupboard where I kept his dog food. The door was open, and little pellets of dog food had spilled all over the kitchen floor. Normally, as soon as I walked through the front door, Angus would greet me with a slobbering grin and wagging tail. This time, I heard nothing. I turned toward the living room and saw him lying on the couch on his back, paws in the air, like a man who had been challenged to a pie-eating contest and had won in double overtime.
"Angus, no!"
I intoned. He rolled his distended belly toward me, then gave me a look that I had only ever received once in my life, from a sorority girl stumbling in front of my college apartment complex right before she projectile vomited on the ground. What happened next did not happen to her, fortunately. I picked up Angus by the sides of his belly and, like a plastic IV bag whose hole had been stretched, a steady stream of diarrhea shot out of his butt onto the couch and floor. That was the final straw. The power of denial is strong, but seeing and smelling your furniture covered in fresh dog diarrhea is stronger. It was time to give Angus away. But I loved him, so I wanted to give him to someone I would be able to visit on occasion to check on him. My brothers and all my friends immediately turned down my request to take Angus. That left one option, my parents. They had a big backyard, and Angus was growing at a ridiculously rapid rate. A dog that I was told would be no bigger than 30 pounds when fully grown weighed 35 pounds at only 4 months. Angus was adorable, and I knew that the best strategy would be to casually show him to my parents before dropping the bomb on them. I wasn't worried about my mom. She was always easy to win over. My dad, of course, was a different story. So, on a sunny Saturday morning in April, I drove down to San Diego with Angus on my lap and walked into my parents' house unannounced, carrying him like an oversized baby.
"Oh, look at him. He's so cute,"
my mom said, coming out from the kitchen where she had been cooking to pet him.
"That is a good-looking dog right there," my dad said, reaching over and rubbing his ears.
"Wait, whose dog is this?"
my mom asked, suddenly suspicious.
"Well, here's the thing," I said. I went on to explain the whole scenario, fudging a few details to make me sound less impulsive and Angus like less of a handful.
"We can't take this dog. This is your responsibility. We can't just take a dog because you didn't think things through,"
my mom said, her tone increasingly annoyed with every word she spoke. I was surprised and became worried because if my mom was reacting like this, I could only imagine what my dad was going to say. He was quiet for a few moments, and then he grabbed Angus and held him up.
"We can take care of him."
"Sam?"
My mom was as surprised as I was.
"It's a dog. It's not like Justin knocked up some lady and he's walking in with a kid."
"Yeah, I didn't do that," I said, chuckling.
"You bet your fucking ass you didn't,"
my dad snapped, without an ounce of humor in his voice. My dad took Angus outside, rubbed his belly, and set him down on the ground.
"This is your new home. Shit and piss where you like,"
he said to Angus. I felt the way I did at age 21 when I gambled in Las Vegas for the first time and won $100 on my first slot machine pull, unsure about what had happened, but confident that I should take off before my luck turned.
"Okay, well, I better get going, you know. I've got work tomorrow, and it's a long drive, so..."
And with that, I hurried down the driveway, got in my car, and drove back to Los Angeles. Every couple of months or so, I'd head home, and each time, Angus would be larger. 8 months later, he was 105 pounds. He looked like Scooby-Doo on steroids.
"Dad, he's so buff. What are you feeding him?" I asked, during a visit around Angus's first birthday.
"In the morning, he gets a half pound of ground beef, half pound of potatoes, and 2 eggs. Then I cook that together and put some garlic salt on it."
Garlic salt? Like he wouldn't eat it if it didn't have garlic salt?
Listen, the dog likes garlic salt, so I give him fucking garlic salt.
So he's eating like 3,000 calories a day?
Well, probably more, since I give him that same meal at night, too.
Jesus Christ, Dad. That's why he looks like a WWF wrestler. My dad explained to me that he had tried lots of traditional dog foods, but that Angus liked human meals cooked for him best. Isn't that a lot of work? I mean, you're like his personal chef. I followed my dad outside as he carried the bowl of food he had just prepared for Angus. The instant he smelled the meal, Angus jumped up in excitement and put his paws on my dad's chest like a long-lost lover.
Okay, take it easy, you crazy son of a bitch, my dad said.
Turning to me, he added,
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but he's my friend.
I couldn't believe what I just heard. Was my dad becoming sentimental in his old age?
Wipe that stupid fucking look off your face. I ain't crazy. They're called man's best friend, for Christ's sakes. It's not like I made that up.
I told him I was glad that Angus had become a good friend.
You know, I was never really a dog person before this. I mean, Brownie was great, but he was your brother's dog. And I had lots of dogs on the farm, but they were work dogs. I guess with all you guys gone and Mom working all the time, it's nice to have somebody around who depends on me. And who tears up my fucking rose garden. God damn it, Angus!
He said, turning and pointing to the churned-up soil that had once hosted his red roses.
He's just like you. He's a pain in my ass, but I love him. And he shits everywhere. Which is mostly why he's like you,
he added with a smirk. On airport pickup duties.
My flight lands at 9:30 on Sunday. You want to watch what? What the fuck is Mad Men? I'm a madman if you don't pick me the hell up.
On built-up expectations.
Your brother brought his baby over this morning. He told me it could stand. It couldn't stand for shit. Just sat there. Big letdown.
On canine leisure time.
The dog is not bored. It's not like he's waiting for me to give him a fucking Rubik's Cube. He's a goddamn dog.
On talking heads.
Do these announcers ever shut the fuck up? Don't ever say stuff just because you think you should. That's the definition of an asshole.
On long-winded anecdotes.
You're like a tornado of bullshit right now. We'll talk again when your bullshit dies out over someone else's house.
On today's hairstyles.
Do people your age know how to comb their fucking hair? It looks like two squirrels crawled on their head and started fucking.
On tailgating the driver in front of me.
You sure do like to tailgate people. Right, because it's real important you show up to the nothing you have to do on time.
On my brother's baby being a little slow to start speaking.
The baby will talk when he talks, relax. It ain't like he knows the cure for cancer and just ain't spitting it out.
On the right time to have children.
It's never the right time to have kids, but it's always the right time for screwing. God's not a dumb shit. He knows how it works.
You have to listen and don't ignore what you hear.
Sometimes life leaves a $100 bill on your dresser, and you don't realize until later it's because it fucked you.
As I mentioned in the introduction to this book, it was a breakup with a girlfriend that landed me back at my parents' house at age 28. Our split hadn't been one of those overdramatic ones where we screamed and cursed each other's names, then I left with the slam of the door and a go to hell. I'd been through a couple breakups before, one of which ended with my ex saying,
Go fuck yourself, you stupid fuck!
That was easy to get over. You don't stay up late at night hoping the woman who called you a stupid fuck comes back. In fact, none of my previous relationships ever felt that serious. But I had been with this girlfriend for 3 years, and I was sure that we were right for each other and had thought we would marry at some point. When she decided to call it quits, it wasn't because of anything specific. Something that had been there before was now missing, and neither of us could figure out what. Our relationship just wasn't working. So when I moved into my parents' house, I was really down. I don't generally wear my emotions on my sleeve, but my dad could tell I was upset.
Sometimes life leaves a $100 bill on your dresser, and you don't realize until later it's because it fucked you,
he said, putting his hand on my shoulder while I was eating breakfast one morning, about a week after I'd moved back home. It's okay. You don't have to try to cheer me up, I replied.
Shit, I know that, he said. But I figured I had to say something. Otherwise, just grabbing the cereal from you and leaving might seem a little callous, he chuckled, hoping to lighten the mood.
The next day, I woke up around 6:30 in the morning. Unable to go back to sleep, I groggily sauntered out into the living room in my boxer shorts. My dad was sitting at the dining room table, eating grape nuts and reading the paper.
When'd you wake up? I asked.
Oh, I don't know. 5 maybe, like usual.
Jesus, that's early. Why do you wake up so early? I said.
Always have.
But why? You're retired now. It makes no sense.
Son, am I being interrogated here? I'm an early riser. What the fuck you want from me?
He said before resuming reading the paper. After a few moments, he put the paper down.
Why are you up so early?
I told him I had woken up and couldn't get back to sleep. He got up from his seat, walked into the kitchen, and poured me a cup of coffee.
You want that bullshit you like in your coffee?
He asked, holding a mug filled with the dark black liquid. Creamer? Yes, I want creamer. He set my coffee down on the table and went back to reading his paper. I poured myself a bowl of cereal, and we sat in silence for a few minutes. My mind was quickly consumed with thoughts of my girlfriend and all the good times we had had, like one of those cheesy montages in 80s movies when the angsty protagonist envisions himself and his ex holding hands on the beach, feeding a small puppy, getting into some kind of zany wrestling match with whipped cream. I interrupted my cliche memories by saying aloud, I'm feeling pretty low about this whole thing.
You just gotta try to put it out of your head, he said,
folding the paper halfway down to look at me. I know, it's just hard. I mean, I still have stuff at her place. What am I gonna do about that? I still have a TV.
Fuck the TV! Leave the TV! Cut your ties!
It's a $1,500 TV, I insisted.
Go get that fucking TV!
I wasn't sure what I was hoping to accomplish by having this conversation, but it wasn't making me feel better. So I went to take a shower, got dressed, and began working on my latest Maxim.com piece, which was, ironically, a flowchart detailing the differences between the male and female brain during an argument. I worked straight until 12:30 when my dad came into the living room. He had his fanny pack on, which indicated he was ready to go somewhere.
I'm buying you lunch. Put your flip-flops on and let's go.
I dragged myself off the couch, followed him outside, hopped in his car, and we headed down the hill to my favorite lunch spot, an Italian place near our house called Pizza Nova. We got a table outside in the sun that overlooked dozens of white clusters of sailboats and motorboats in the San Diego harbor. The waitress brought us a basket of garlic rolls and a pair of iced teas. My dad took a sip of his and looked up at me.
You don't know shit about me.
Okay, I said, a little confused.
About my life. You don't know shit about it, because I don't tell anybody.
It wasn't until he said it that I realized he was right. Sure, I knew the rough outline of my dad's biography. He grew up on a farm in Kentucky, served in Vietnam, had 2 sons with his first wife, who passed away from cancer shortly after having my brother Evan, married my mom 9 years later and had me, and spent his career doing cancer research as a doctor of nuclear medicine. But that was it. Now that I was thinking about it, I realized he was probably the most private person I knew.
When I was in my early 20s, I was head over heels for this woman. She was gorgeous, just a real beauty, and full of life,
he said between bites of a garlic roll. Most of us like to assume, or wish, that our parents only had sex with each other, and only the necessary number of times it took to produce us and our siblings, so it was strange to hear my dad talk so highly about a woman other than my mother. He never had before, and I was intrigued.
So, me and her, we dated for a while, a long while. Then, one day, we got to talking, and I told her how much I loved her. And she looked at me and told me, I don't love you. I never will,
he continued.
I'll have a sausage and pepperoni pizza with the salad, he said,
turning to the waitress, who had been awkwardly standing next to our table, waiting for my dad to finish his story so she could take our order. I placed my order, and the waitress left.
So what'd you do? I asked.
I told her I thought that I could change that. Maybe she didn't love me right now, but she would eventually.
What'd she say?
She said okay, and we stayed together, and we fought. We fought a lot. And then I realized I had made a big mistake. She had given me her youth, and it was gone. And I didn't know how to get out of it. And then she got sick, and she was dying,
he said, taking a deep breath, thinking for a moment, as if he were replaying something in his mind he hadn't thought of in a long time.
So I made good with her, and I stuck by her, and then she died. And I felt horrible. Because I felt like here was this woman who didn't want to be with me. She told me that, and I ignored it. And she was spending the end of her life with someone she didn't love, and now she was gone. And part of me felt relieved that I was freed out of this relationship, and that made me feel so terrible, I couldn't deal with it.
My dad sat back in his wicker chair for a few quiet moments. The waitress arrived with our food, and he picked at his salad before looking up at me.
People are always trying to tell you how they feel. Some of them say it outright, and some of them, they tell you with their actions, and you have to listen. I don't know what will happen with your lady friend. I think she's a nice person, and I hope you get what you want. But do me a favor, listen, and don't ignore what you hear.
A few months later, I began writing this book. I sat down with family and friends, rehashing many different stories about me and my dad. We recalled things he said and things they said, and we pieced together as best we could everything that's in these pages. As I was finishing up in December 2009, my dad called me one day while I was out buying groceries at Trader Joe's.
Hey,
he said. Hey, what's happening? I asked.
I know what your last chapter is,
he said. Oh, yeah? And then he told me he wanted this story to be the last chapter. I told him that this anecdote and the advice that accompanied it had meant a lot to me, but I realized how personal it was and how private he was. I asked him why he wanted it to be the last chapter and told him that the request seemed out of character for a guy who a month prior had told me that he'd consider pulling his shotgun on any reporter who came too close asking questions about this book.
Well, I figure this book is about you and me. I mean, I'm the star, but you're in it too,
he laughed.
And when I told you that story, you were hurting. So I guess I want people to know that maybe I'm not the warmest human being on the fucking planet, but I love the shit out of you. The story I told you, the reason I don't tell nobody is because I never had a reason to. You're a pretty together kid.
Thanks, I appreciate...
Don't get me wrong, you got a big fucking mouth, and you ain't the prettiest to look at, but I love you. And I want people to know that when it comes down to it, I'd do things for my family that I wouldn't do for nobody else.
A week or so later, I finished the book. I was at the end of an all-nighter and strolled into the living room where my dad was eating breakfast and reading the paper.
I'm done! I finished the book,
I boasted.
I cannot believe someone is going to publish something you wrote,
he said. I know, crazy, right?
You have never, ever in your life had anything published, ever. You never had one goddamn word of yours published anywhere,
he said, still in disbelief. My dad has never counted my online writings published or publishable.
I mean, not one fucking thing. Not a thing. And now you're going to have a book in stores and shit? Jesus H. Christ. Unfucking believable. To think,
okay, I get it. I've never published anything. I'm the luckiest person on earth. I don't deserve it. I get it. I shouted.
Oh, shit. Sorry, son. I didn't mean to bust your balls there. It's just, well, it's fucking unbelievable, that's all.
He paused and offered me a seat on the couch next to him.
Congratulations. I'm proud of you. Have some grape nuts.
He poured me a bowl and handed me the sports section. It was quiet for a few moments as we ate breakfast and read the paper.
It's just, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around it,
he said, looking up from his paper again and shaking his head.
I mean, they gave you money to do this? You? Amazing.
This recording of Shit My Dad Says by Justin Halpern was produced by Paul Rubin Productions and performed by Sean Schemmel. It was recorded, edited, mixed, and mastered by John Marshall Sound. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.